Hello and welcome to episode number 11 of the Take One podcast from All Sociology. My name is Ben, I'm going to be your host today, and today what we're going to be doing is something a little bit different to my usual kind of sociological podcast. This is a very much a different type of podcast and not one that's going to be sort of focused on helping you to pass an exam, but one that's going to apply some sociological concepts to the worldwide phenomena that we've all come to know as coronavirus. So this is the 11th podcast and certainly not one that I planned on doing a couple of weeks ago, but we've got it nonetheless. I think it's a really interesting topic and one that we can apply a lot of sociological concepts and theories and ideas to, and that's basically what I'm going to do over the next half an hour or so. So what is this podcast? It's a podcast on a variety of different, as I say, sociological concepts and explanations and ideas and theories that are applicable to the coronavirus and the pandemic that we're currently experiencing, both at home here in the UK and indeed around the world. What is this not? This is nothing scientific. It's got no explanation of the virology of it, the spread of it, or the prevention of it, or even a cure, or anything like that. It's also not a podcast that's directed at a specific audience. This one is genuinely a podcast for everybody, and I'm hoping that the concepts that I'll be using and drawing on throughout the podcast will be ones that are fairly familiar to you if you're studying sociology at any level. So at the bottom level at GCSE, through A level, all the way up to degree and postgraduate level as well. Okay, so that's basically what's been going on. If you've been under a rock for the past sort of couple of months, I suppose, really, the coronavirus is a virus that's really been spreading around the world and causing flu-like and respiratory symptoms that have the potential to do some really serious damage to people. And it's actually got a very high fatality rate already. I think what we need to know about it at the moment, clearly, is there's no vaccine or any cure. It's a virus that's passed through human contact and those kind of things. And not only is there a physiological impact on people's health, it's also clearly having a massive impact, knock-on effect, on the economy and the global market. So this is a seriously big deal. It's something that sort of 3 months ago nobody really had any idea about, and it's impacting every single aspect of our society. So what better place to talk about it than on a sociology podcast that's all done in one take and recorded by some bloke in his living room? So that's what we're going to be doing today. excuse me, where am I coming at this from? It's March the 21st, 2020 in the UK. It's Saturday. It's a really, really weird time at the moment. Year 11 and year 13 at my school have just left school. Schools have been shut in Britain for everyone apart from the most vulnerable and children of what we call key workers, people who we need to keep going, working in the system to keep the country going and making sure that everyone stays as healthy as possible. So that's basically what the kind of the context is at the moment. I've got lots and lots to say on the end of school. I've got lots of things to say personally to my year 11 and particularly my year 13 students. I will not do that on this podcast. This isn't necessarily the platform to do it. I want to offer you a personal message, and I will get back to you all very, very shortly. So do just hang in there if you're one of mine. Just for everyone else, hope everyone's staying as safe as they can. Hope everyone's like washing their hands and doing everything they can to, you know, increase their social distancing, as the government are calling it, between people. So staying at home, not going out, certainly not touching people, not sharing, you know, pints and things like that. It's really important that we listen to this advice. So I won't be talking about that too much as we go on, but it will be a lot about sociological explanations of it. So before we really get rocking into it, welcome to anyone who's a new listener to this. Welcome to anyone who's an old listener to this. Some of you have been listening all the way through, and I really, really appreciate your support. I've had so many comments from people saying, are you still going to keep doing these now that school's off? And are you still going to keep doing them now that the exam's maybe not taking place? Yeah, of course I am. In fact, if anything, I'm probably going to up them a little bit because I'm still going to be going into school. I'm going to be doing some key worker cover myself, put my hand up for that. But I should have a little bit more time on evenings and weekends where I normally do a lot of lesson preparation and stuff like that. I don't necessarily have to do that as much now, so I'll be putting a few more of these out in the next sort of few weeks and stuff, so hopefully you'll enjoy them. I also want to give a bit of a shout out to anyone who's self-isolated, well done, particularly my mum and dad. I know they're at home, I'm doing little jobs for them and stuff at the moment, so hi to my mum and dad who are self-isolating at the moment. Anyone else who's self-isolating, whether you've got symptoms or whether you haven't got symptoms, well done to you, just keep doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're doing your job, you're fulfilling your function as the country and the world requires you to do it, so please keep doing it. Shout out massively to the healthcare and social care professionals and anyone working in public services or anyone in those key worker jobs. absolutely take my hat off to you. You are so, so helpful at this time. So thank you very much. If you've indeed work in any of those professions where you've got parents, family, friends, say thank you to them from me, because they're doing a wonderful job. And the more they keep working, the more closer we're going to getting this resolved and through it. So I'm not going to talk too much about like the kind of the biological or that kind of stuff, but it's very much going to be about the social impact today. So before I get into what we're going to do, I've been doing this stuff on Instagram. If you don't follow already, it's at All Sociology on Instagram. Go and have a look. Every day I do a daily quiz with an easy, medium and hard question. On a Wednesday, I do a world-class Wednesday question. And recently, this was on the 11th of March, Wednesday 11th of March, a couple of weeks ago, I asked my followers for the world-class Wednesday question, which was, what are Walter Miller's six focal concerns? Now, what I was looking for here was something on the lines of autonomy, excitement, fate, smartness, toughness and trouble. Only four people actually managed to get that one right. So a massive shout out to you. The following four people: Georgia Whelan, Georgie_GW, Jack Ted Smith and Umar London. Very, very well done to you. You were the only four people to have got all six of those right. Honourable mentions to Davina.Potter and Dave Wakefield, also for giving a couple of them. I'll do another load of shout outs at the end for those who got the question right a couple of days ago on the 19th of March as well. So I'm really sorry, that's taken an awful long time. I'm already at like 6 minutes. I've not even got through my intro. So this is probably going to be a long podcast. I don't know how long it's going to take. As you know, I don't really plan what I'm going to say. I've got some rough ideas. I've written a couple of things down, but it could go on for 20 minutes. It could end up going on for an hour. I really don't know. But I hope that whoever you are and wherever you listen, that it's of some sort of interest to you and you're able to see how we can apply sociology and some of the concepts that we use outside of the classroom and actually outside to the real world issues. So what I'm going to be talking about today, I've picked out like a bunch of kind of concepts that I think apply to the coronavirus and that we can use. They are in the order in which I'm going to run through them. Number one might not be a surprise to anybody. It's the concept of moral panic. So I'm going to discuss about whether or not coronavirus can be seen as a moral panic, and if it can, why is that? What does it draw from the conceptual ideas that we originally associate with moral panic? Alongside that, and very much related to it, I'm going to be looking at the role of the media in the spread of this information about this. So how do we all know about coronavirus? Ultimately, it's 99.9% of us through the media. That's an incredibly important agent of socialization. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that, how that socialized us, how that's affected our behavior. Before then, starting to sort of move on to looking at the social construction and the relativity of deviance, and about how what we consider to be deviant is actually changing all the time, purely because of the sort of moving target nature of this pandemic and the way that things are constantly shifting all the time. So I find that really, really interesting. I've got a couple of anecdotes that will help explain that as well. And then we're going to finish off by thinking about the ways in which the coronavirus is inspired and established a new form of social control. So I'll be looking at informal social control, formal social control, and also finishing up with a little discussion of surveillance. And obviously I'm going to be linking that idea of surveillance to Michel Foucault as well. So that's essentially the rundown. My God, I've already been 8 minutes. This is going to take ages. I really apologise. The other thing I'll say just before I start as well is it's a very unusual time at the moment. There's a high level of anomie. People aren't doing what they would normally do on a daily basis. And so you might sense a little bit of like, I've got a very croaky voice at the moment. I've been very, very tired. I've not really slept much recently. And I'm quite frankly been exhausted the last sort of couple of weeks. So apologies if I sound a little bit croaky. Hopefully it will add to the atmosphere. Before we really get into the gist of it, oh my God, I will start this in a minute, I promise. I've got a couple of drinks, as I always have with me. I'm sat at home in my living room. I've got a cup of coffee, which is nice, a couple of sugars in it, and a milk, because it's a Saturday, I treat myself. I normally drink black coffee, but I do treat myself at the weekend. I know, rock and roll lifestyle of a sociology teacher. And I've also got a orange, pineapple and lemon squash today. I don't normally buy this one because shops are running out of different stuff. I went to a different shop and I managed to get myself some orange, lemon and pineapple squash. It's really nice, actually. I haven't had it for years and it's lovely. So there we go. That's going to keep me hydrated. Have a quick sip of coffee and we'll rock into some stuff about moral panics. Excuse me. Right. So moral panics and the coronavirus. Well, first of all, let's talk about what a moral panic is. So a definition of a moral panic, a basic dictionary definition, I suppose, would be this idea of public anxiety or alarm that's caused in response to a problem that's seen as threatening to society. Okay, so it's the reaction of panic or anxiety to a phenomena or a problem that happens in society that threatens our well-being. And Stan Cohen is a very useful sociological theorist when it comes to this, because he's the guy who basically coins this term, moral panic. And he defines this as a condition, episode, person or group of persons who emerges to become defined as a threat to societal values and interests. And that quote is a direct quote from Cohen's 1972 work, Folk Devils and Moral Panics. Effectively, what we're thinking about here is a situation where something happens in society and it then starts to cause a great deal of alarm. And often that alarm is amplified and passed on to us through the role of the media. And I'm going to talk a lot about the media in a minute, but for the moment, I'm just going to hold fire on the concept of moral panic. So moral panic is normally a concept that's attached to like a phenomena or something that happens in society that shows a degradation of values, like something that's going to chip away at what we are and why we are the people we are. And in previous times, like, it's shown sort of groups of people behaving in particular ways that are at odds with social norms. You know, they're different to us. So it's also been applied not only to people, but also to different kind of material objects. So things like what we call video nasties, which are violent horror films or violent slasher films that particularly caused a moral panic around the James Bulger case in 1993, where a very young toddler was tragically murdered and killed by two other boys, both aged 10 at the time. And the blame for that was put on the role of the media, and particularly these video nasties that they've been watching. So things like Child's Play, the Chucky films, those kind of things. Okay, so it's put onto that at various times. It's also been put on, one of the examples I often use with my students is the moral panic around sort of drill music and grime and trap, and a way in which that glamorises violence, it glamorises knife crime and baiting people out and all of that kind of stuff. And that's also been picked up by the media as an explanation for why we've got high levels of gang violence or youth violence or knife crime amongst young people, particularly in inner city environments as well. So the concept of moral panic has been applied to people and things throughout time. And normally, when we look at what a moral panic is, we normally associate with there being some sort of level of scapegoat. There's someone to blame. And in various different cases, it's been various different things. But what Cohen calls this thing or this person to scapegoat is a folk devil. Now, in Cohen's original 1972 work, Mods and Rockers, Moral Panics, the scapegoat or the folk devil was these two youth groups, Mods and Rockers, who were basically involved in a lot of youth clashes in seaside towns on bank holiday weekends in England in the 1960s and 1970s. And so a lot of the fear was about the ways in which these young people were showing a complete lack of normative understanding and understanding of the rules and the culture in which we live. We've seen it in other cases as well. So in 1978, Stuart Hall conducted his or wrote his book, Police in the Crisis. And in that, the moral panic was all about mugging. So the street crime of mugging, and the folk devil was young black lads, because they were very much portrayed as the ones to blame for this mugging, despite the fact that mugging in one form or another had been going on in Britain for hundreds of years. But young black men were considered to be the folk devil in that situation. So there's usually a clear scapegoat or someone to blame alongside the threat to society's values and well-being. However, using the definition that we've got from the dictionary definition and Cohen's definition, we can easily apply this to the coronavirus. The spread of the virus and the spread of the news of it, and those are separate things as well, and our helplessness in all of this, that's the panic part of it, right? So we know something's happening, we know that we're potentially at threat, that's the panic part. The moral part, I think, is how we need to uphold norms and uphold and conform to social control in dealing with it. You know, we need to make sure that everyone is doing what they're told to do. You know, we're generally pretty good at doing that in this country on the whole, and I think that we consider that like the compliance or cooperation with the government and the state to be a moral thing to do, particularly in this situation. So I think that's part of it as well. And the folk devil part, well, there are already people who are being blamed and scapegoated for this spread of this disease, in the form of some Chinese people who've reported discrimination. If you've seen anything coming out of the US in terms of the rhetoric that Donald Trump is using, he's not talking about this as a virus or as a coronavirus or COVID-19. He's talking about it as a Chinese virus, and he is most certainly laying the blame principally on China and Chinese citizens for this. So definitely for Donald Trump, the scapegoat and the folk devil is Chinese people. But there's also, I think, in this country as well, we're starting to, quite rightly in my opinion, scapegoat and folk devilise those people who are not listening to the public health advice. So if you're in the UK at the moment, you'll probably be aware that several kind of sections of society have been encouraged to self-isolate. So I'll give an example, like older people, for instance, anyone over the age of 70, anyone with underlying health conditions. So if you've got things like asthma or anything like that, you're the people who are generally at risk. So a lot of people are starting to sort of scapegoat those people who aren't perhaps doing what they're told. So the people who are still going out, still socially mixing with people. Up until recently, literally last night, the Prime Minister called time on pubs closing. I know there's been loads of older people, all sorts of people, in fact, who have been going out to the pubs still and ignoring that advice. And clearly the government's had to put that in place to try and quell or stem the tide of people bundling into pubs and thinking, oh, this is my last chance to have a drink. It's interesting, actually, because I'm 34, and so I've had, you know, 16 years of going to the pub and all of that, and so it's no major loss. I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I like going for a drink. I really like my local. It's no major loss to me, but I can really, really feel for those of you, perhaps, who haven't had that 14 years of pub-going experience and who've just turned 18. I know there was a student that I teach turned 18 just recently, and of course, you're going to want to go out, so I can understand the frustration around that as well. But please, I think one of the key things as well, if you don't want to be ostracised, you don't want to be turned into a folk devil or scapegoat, just stay and listen to the advice as well. Okay. So the other thing as well, we're starting to sort of see with scapegoating people is these panic buyers. And originally, there's kind of stocks like toilet roll, hand sanitizer, hand soap, all of those kind of things, bread, they were flying off the shelves like nobody's business. And I think people now have kind of come around to this idea that that is not the way to do it, and it really isn't very fair on some people. So we've seen examples of people kind of calling each other out. You know, you don't need a trolley load of chopped tomatoes, or you don't need 2,000 toilet rolls and stuff like that. It's just not fair. So we're starting to see the folk devil concept being applied to both people internationally. So for example, from Donald Trump's view, for the Chinese, and more locally at home, we're starting to see the folk devils coming out as people who aren't listening to government advice, and also who are panic buying and perhaps making the whole situation a little bit more difficult for everybody. And the demonisation of particular groups, I think, is something that could be a real issue. What I mean by demonisation is when you basically pick out a particular group and you really extremely scapegoat them, and you blame all problems on them. They're the problem. They're the ones that's making this situation worse. So demonisation is an issue I think we're going to have to be very, very careful about as a knock-on effect of coronavirus in this country. So just recently, we've heard that, you know, over 70 should stay indoors. Any older people could immediately be demonised. We've heard of Chinese people being demonised as well. I think there's a thing called maskophobia as well. So anyone who's wearing a surgical mask is being kind of discriminated against and those kind of things, particularly if you are of Chinese or East Asian in origin. People are ultimately being racist towards you, and that's a concern societally as a knock-on effect of this as well. But again, you know, keep an eye on this and be aware of the demonisation of particular groups. We'll start seeing this as things start moving along a bit further. Perhaps, hopefully, as we come towards a resolution and a vaccine, that's when people are going to start pointing fingers, and I think we'll start to see this an awful lot more. And I think, why is this really? Like, I think society often has to, or it feels like it has to, find a visible group to blame or scapegoat for something, even when the threat's invisible and that there may indeed be entirely no blame for this at all. You know, it's a naturally occurring occurrence. So, I mean, in that respect, like, coronavirus is certainly a moral panic. It's got the moral part of it. It's got the panic part of it. It's got its folk devils. But it also could obviously be argued that coronavirus doesn't quite fit the moral part of moral panic, because there isn't a clear folk devil. We're not really... The clear threat is the disease itself. It isn't necessarily people, despite the fact how people are reacting. But this may well be because this is such an unprecedented situation that we've never had to or tried to apply moral panics to a viral pandemic before, until now. So perhaps it's just, perhaps the concept doesn't quite neatly fit because we've never had to do this before. And certainly from the people I've been speaking to, this is you'll hear this word a lot, unprecedented. It's unprecedented because it hasn't ever happened before. You know, even the older people that I've spoken to recently can't remember anything like this. It's different when you talk to them about the war. It's different to how it was in the war. So it's a really new, evolving thing all of the time. I think when we talk about moral panics, we've always got to talk about the role of the media as well. And that's the thing I'm going to come on to talk about now. So like, either way, a huge link between the coronavirus and the idea of moral panic is the concept of the media and the role of the media and what they're doing in this. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this now. So, I mean, most of us are getting our information from COVID-19. Not getting our information from there. We're getting our information on COVID-19 and the coronavirus from the media. And in this way, the media is clearly acting as an agent of socialisation. We know the stuff we do, not because our family tell us, not because we learn it at school, but because we're watching it through to 24-hour news channels. We're constantly seeing it on our updates, on our, like our BBC updates. We're seeing it on Twitter. We're see, you know, it's everywhere. And that's the media telling us all of this stuff. The media is playing a really key role in the spread of information. But I think one of the things that's so sociologists we have to think about is the ethics of this, the responsibility of this, and the representation of this, and the extent to which whether what we're hearing in the media is also actually spreading fear as well as information. So again, thinking about like the concept of deviancy amplification and media amplification, like having this threat sensationalized, and is that potentially the way in which it's reporting, is that reporting leading to this irrational, dysfunctional behavior with things like panic buying? Or are they just saying how it is, you know? So I remember last Saturday, I was at home and I was working and I got up really early and I thought, oh, I'm going to stick the news on. I never normally watch the TV, and the TV was on basically all day last Saturday. And one of the things that I often try and do is like think about how I can go without watching the news for a little while. And it sounds ridiculous, right? But for about 4 days before last Saturday, I hadn't really seen the news much, and that's partly purposefully, but also I quite like doing it just to see like sometimes how life is when you're not paying attention to what's going on outside of you. And sometimes, you know, when you're really busy, I think I've just got to focus on myself. Anyway, I'm blabbing on, but when I was watching the news the other week, I noticed myself physically and like metaphysically getting more and more anxious about what was going on, because the media were reporting on the food shortages. They were talking about how shelves were bare, and I hadn't actually stepped out of my house to see this. Like, I was just seeing it on the media, and I was sat there writing away a lesson or something, or marking some books or something, and kept on thinking, Jesus, I need to go out and get some stuff. I should probably go out and get some stuff, because if I don't get anything now, then maybe there'll be nothing left. Long and the short of it is that I didn't bother. I ended up staying in, and it all worked out fine. But the fact is that through watching the news, that had almost a physical effect on me to get up, put my shoes on, go out and go down to the shop and buy milk or whatever else it was that I needed. Okay, so there we go. That's like one personal anecdote of how the media has had an actual effect on me because of the way that I often go through these news amnesties. Now, a lot of people are constantly watching the news, and they equally are not immune from this kind of stuff as well. So I've heard a lot of people talk about they are constantly stuck, you know, glued to watching the news, particularly if you're at home, you're self-isolated, you haven't got an awful lot to do. That's going to be the natural thing to do. And it is that representation of news, is the spread of information actually, because of what's been said and the volume at which it's been said in the global media age in which we live, is that having a negative effect on us and actually spreading fear? I'm sure that the media have, you know, they have their own responsibilities to do this thing, but and I think that even if they're considering this, I think sometimes unintentionally it will come out in that way. I think that talking about representation, it's a really, really key thing, really. I mean, like, the way what we see often has an effect on how we think about things. And, excuse me, the representation we've seen in the media recently has been, I think, generally fair, but there's definitely been some elements of sensationalism creeping in. So, like, last, I think it was a couple of days ago, the Daily Mail ran a headline. Don't worry, I don't read the Daily Mail, but it just happened to crop up, and it's a good example. The Daily Mail ran a headline about soldiers guarding supermarkets in South London. There were some photographs circulating around from WhatsApp groups that I'm in of soldiers on the streets of Clapham and places like that. And again, is this sensationalising this idea that, sugar, we're about to go into a lockdown, the army on the streets, we've entered into this state of martial law? Is this, you know, is this true? Is this real? Is this representative of the whole country? Because as I understand it, I don't live in London anymore, but I've obviously got lots of friends who live there, and my brother lives there. The way I understand it, it feels like the phenomena is more acutely felt in London than it is in the other parts of the country? And given the fact that most news agencies are based in London, does that then create a kind of a biased effect on the way in which they're reporting news? Who knows? There's also, obviously, the instance of fake news. I'm not going to talk too much about misinformation and fake news. And by this, what I mean is things that might circulate on social media, things that might circulate on your WhatsApp groups, those kind of things. I'll give you an example. This week, so I'm in a WhatsApp group with all my friends, and a lot of us are spread out all over the place. And someone put a video on of riots in Peckham in southeast London, saying like, whoa, what's happening here? Like, my God, people are actually rioting at the supermarkets to get all the food and stuff. And that was sent to him from somebody else. But then one of my mates who actually lives in Peckham said, nah, mate, that's actually from the London riots in 2011. And the shop at which this was all taking place has now turned into a Costa or something. So, like, it's easily spread. And you need to be aware, I think, be critical about and analytical about what information you get and what sense you make of it, because, you know, some people do just run and run with this. They take it at face value, and that is what gets us into these panic situations. So the other thing I'm not going to talk about a lot, but I could do a whole flipping podcast about this. I'm not going to talk about globalization in this podcast, purely because I'm already at like 26 minutes. I could do a whole podcast on talking about the concept of globalisation and coronavirus. I'm not going to, because I want to keep it relatively focused on the media. And just to finish off this little discussion of the media, I'm going to bring in a theorist called Jean Baudrillard. Baudrillard's a postmodernist, and I love his ideas. They're crazy, but if you kind of run with them a little bit, you'll totally understand what he's saying. Baudrillard uses a couple of concepts. He uses the concept of hyperreality and simulacrum. And both of these relate to the media in the way that we're not actually... Hyperreality is the idea that we're experiencing something through a simulation that someone else has provided to us, right? So what Baudrillard's talking about and how we can apply Baudrillard's concept to the coronavirus is that we are, for the most of us, whether you like it or not, or whether you think you do or not, most of us are experiencing this crisis and this pandemic through the lens of the media. Like, none of us like would kind of know about this at all if it were not for our media saturated and globally connected, or what Manuel Castells might call a network society in which we live. None of us would know about it. We would be completely blissfully unaware. But this is a reality, and we're making it our reality through living it through the media. So Baudrillard talks about we're living in a simulacra, or a simulation of the world. We're not actually first-hand experiencing this, but we are getting it through the media. And as a result of this, what it's creating is this hyper-real situation. I'm not for a single moment saying that the coronavirus is bollocks and it's all a load of rubbish. It's not. It's clearly a thing. But what I'm saying, and using Baudrillard's ideas, is that chances are, hopefully, I keep my fingers crossed for you, hopefully you haven't actually yet experienced this firsthand. You haven't actually had it yourself. You may not have known anyone who's actually had it. But we're hearing all of this stuff through the media. So we've got this sense that what we're seeing through our TV sets, what we're seeing through our iPhones and our Android handsets and whatever else, is actually real. And it is, but it's not happening to us. So that's another thing I wanted to bring on there. And the role of the media, I mean, again, I could go for ages on this. I'm not going to, purely because I think everyone's going to be falling asleep in about 3 minutes if I do. So instead of that, I'm going to have a quick drink. And I'm going to rock on to talking about social construction of deviance and relativity of deviance in relation to the coronavirus. So give me a minute. Coffee's gone cold, by the way, but it doesn't matter, does it? Right, so social construction of deviance and relativity of deviance. What do I mean by this? Well, a social construction is something that humans and society has effectively made up, and that it doesn't exist in the natural world. Relativity is the idea that things are not always the same. Things are not universal. So sometimes we talk about like relativity or social construction of laws. I'll give you an example. In France, if you are 16, you are absolutely legally entitled and allowed to go into a bar and get yourself an alcoholic drink, glass of wine, or a nice pint of beer or whatever. In Britain, you cannot do that until you are 18. So if you go and try and buy a drink, alcoholic drink in a bar in Britain when you were 16, you are committing an offence. You're attempting to buy alcohol illegally. You have to wait until you're 18. So in France, totally legal to be a 16-year-old having a pint in a pub. In Britain, that's illegal. In America, you try and do that when you are 20, then you are still committing an offence and you're breaking the law. Because obviously in America you need to be 21 to buy and drink alcohol. So that's just an example about the ways in which one thing changes according to different societies. And we've socially constructed this rule. This idea that basically children shouldn't drink alcohol is something that humans have made up. You know, you go back in history, hundreds of years ago, before we had things like clean drinking water and we had big outbreaks of horrible diseases like cholera and all those kind of things, people were drinking all the time because it was the only way we could actually hydrate ourselves without getting ill through drinking dirty water. So that is an example of what I mean by social construction of deviance. Now, what the hell has any of that stuff got to do with the coronavirus? Well, what I'm going to talk about is about the ways in which the last couple of weeks, certainly in Britain, what we've all been told about is kind of two things. Like one, like washing your hands and making sure that we're taking precautions by washing our hands thoroughly and in a particular way. If you've seen the videos, you've got to sing yourself happy birthday twice while washing your hands with soap and water on the backs and the fronts of your hands and all of that kind of stuff. So that's what's been told to us. And the other thing I'm going to talk about in a minute is again about bulk buying. But I'm going to focus on washing hands first of all. So a couple of weeks ago, like, the concept of washing your hands was, you know, something that you would like to think most people in this country would do, especially after they've, like, you know, touched something, they've been to the toilet or whatever, anything like that, right? And a couple of weeks ago, I'm going to tell you a story, because a couple of weeks ago, this would not have happened. As I say, the expectation, the norm, if you will, of people is to wash your hands after going to the loo. Now, this is not always the norm in a gents' toilet in a pub. If you've ever been in a gents' in a pub, you will know that there are a variety of types of people who have varieties of levels of cleanliness and hygiene. You get people who don't wash their hands after going to the toilet. You get people who do wash their hands. And you get those in the middle who kind of just sort of like go for a wee and they go to the sink and they kind of turn the tap on, run their hands under really quickly and then walk out. You know, you've got these different kind of levels of adherence to wash and have hands, right? But in the last couple of weeks, this has all changed. And normally, people don't really give a damn about that. I mean, it's gross and whatever else, but you're not going to go, ugh, mate, I've just seen you have a wee and you've not washed your hands. No one cares. Like, just carry on as you normally are. But this has all started to change. So I was in the pub a couple of weeks ago. Pubs are now closed, so I can't even go there anymore. But so I'll tell you about it. And you might probably get the feeling that as much as I can survive without the pub, I do miss it a little bit. I was in the pub and I went for a wee. And when I went in there, there was two blokes already in the bathroom. And one bloke was already washing his hands. One guy was having a wee. I went up to do me business and stuff. And the geezer who was washing his hands was then starting to dry his hands under the dryer. The fella who was next to me, who just finished going to the toilet, he then made a beeline for the exit. Now, what happened next was something that wouldn't have happened a few weeks ago. Because of the way in which we've now been socialised to make sure we really wash our hands, and we've almost had this view that, you know, washing your hands is deviant. It's not a crime, but my God, you shouldn't be not doing that because it's really important. The bloke who was at the dryer said to the other fella, "Oi, mate, what are you doing?" And the guy was like, "What do you mean?" It's like, "You need to wash your hands." And the bloke actually came back from coming, just about to leave the toilet, came back into the hut and washed his hands. Now, this is a really good example of the fact that we've socially constructed not washing your hands as deviant, right? A couple of weeks ago, this wouldn't have happened. People wouldn't have cared at all. But, you know, this bloke actually said, "Mate, wash your hands. Like, you've got a responsibility to do this." So I found that to be a really interesting thing. And the way in which we as a society, individually and collectively, even if it is a couple of blokes in a pub, are changing the way we think about things, and we're socially constructing what is now considered to be deviant that 2, 3, 4 weeks ago certainly wouldn't have been. So I'm not going to tell you where, well, I wasn't going to tell you where my pub was, but now, given the fact no one can go to the pub, it doesn't really matter anyway. So the pub I go to is the Greyhound. I know some of you want to know that, but you ain't going to see me in there for a while because it's going to be shut for a while. So that's where I normally drink, but there you go. I think the other thing I'm going to talk about as well with this is not only about washing your hands, but also about this panic buying. Now, this is something that's actually quite upset me a little bit. I live on my own, and so I live pretty frugally. I don't, like, buy lots of food. And more often than not, my cupboards are empty. I buy food when I need it, you know. And so I've found this quite difficult because there's not really been much food in the shops. But I'm the least of the worries because at least I've got, like, a lunch break. I finish at, you know, my school day finishes at 3:30. I can get to the supermarket before 5 o'clock or whatever. I've been going to get my mum and dad loads of stuff. It's quite difficult. But if you go and you've got a bit of time and you don't rush and you're quite happy to accept other things. That's, you know, replacements for things you might want anyway. That's awesome. But what I'm talking about here is, again, the way in which we've socially constructed it to be incredibly deviant about panic buying, and the way in which this is slightly, and this is going to lead on to this in a minute, leading to elements of informal social control. So you might have seen, it's been flying around the internet recently, it was a viral clip of an NHS worker having come off a 48-hour shift and basically crying because she'd tried to go to the supermarket to get some groceries, basic stuff, you know, like fruit and veg and that, and couldn't get anything because basically everyone had panic bought and literally like giant Pac-Men eating their way through the supermarket. And I think at first people were certainly anecdotally, just basing it on what I'd heard from people, were kind of almost seeing it as almost like a triumph. Oh, great, man, I've got myself like a bunch of beans, or I've got myself some toilet roll, I've got this and got that, and I've got loads of this, I'm fine for that for ages. And I think now what we've come into, as well as people doing this themselves and constructing this behaviour as very much deviant, almost on criminal and certainly irresponsible, of panic buying, we're now starting to see the media reinforce this as well through sort of informal social control. So like, on the way home yesterday, actually funnily enough, on the way home from doing a care package delivery to my parents, I was listening to the radio and he had a fellow called Tony Livesey, he was on Radio 5, really good bloke, and he was talking about this particular clip of this woman who had been crying, this NHS worker who'd been crying because she couldn't get any food. And his words were somewhere along the lines of, you know, once this has all been said and done, those who panic bought will need to take a very long hard look at themselves in the mirror. And what Tony Livesey is doing there is effectively chastising these people, calling these people out and saying that what you've done is incredibly deviant. It's not illegal, but it's definitely deviant. It's something you should be basically publicly criticised for and shamed for and potentially ostracised for that kind of behaviour. So that's a little bit about how we've socially constructed different elements of deviance over the last sort of few weeks with this, particularly in regards to washing your hands, and I gave you the example there of the pub, and also in terms of panic buying and the ways in which we're now starting to see people that are publicly baited out for this, or to use the proper term, you know, they're ostracised and criticised for it, okay? So I'll have my last slip of coffee before I start to talk about social control, and this will be the last thing that I'm really talking about. I'm going to do a little wrap up, and then I'm going to do some shout outs at the end for anyone who got the World Class Wednesday question correct on Instagram. But this is quite an interesting one, thinking about the levels of social control that we've got in society and how this works. Now, this, I'll come back to this word again, unprecedented. This is an unprecedented situation. We've never before had something like this, where effectively states have had to take it into their own hands and reduce or strip back or completely take away some of the freedoms that the Western world's been built on, you know, freedom of movement and all that kind of stuff. So in my discussion of social control, I'm going to look at elements of formal social control to start off with. So we can see this through state-issued instruction, not guidance, but state-issued instruction that you are not allowed to leave your home or go out unless it's for key work, so for instance you work in a hospital, or if you need to get food or you need to get medicines. And that's been the case in Spain and Italy. These are both advanced Western industrial, sort of post-industrial economies and countries. Both of these have had lockdowns imposed on them. In Russia, we've seen that there's been threats of prison if restrictions are broken. So again, they've got restricted movement and freedom in Russia. Again, people are being threatened there by sanctions of prison. I think it's a couple of years in prison if you break these. So these are serious, serious levels of social control that have been formally issued by agents whose role it is to control us. And ultimately, at some point or other, the government's role is that. So you can definitely describe this as formal social control. I think when we start to think about it in the UK, so formal social control in the UK, what can we potentially see? I mean, we don't know. Will the army be called in? I mean, when I ever teach social control to year 10 at GCSE, I always talk about, you know, obviously it's the police, the prisons, the courts. And the worst case scenario is the army being called in, because the police and our, what we might call like our, I don't know, like our home enforcement services, like, you know, people we normally see out on the streets, can't cope. So we might end up having to bring the army in for this, the highest level of social control. Will we end up being isolated and locked down like they are in Italy and Spain? Are we going to be quarantined at home? Well, that's already started to some level, with certain groups of people being told, for instance, the over 70s and those with underlying health concerns, been told to stay at home. Pubs have now been shut. This has never even happened, not even in the bloody war. I don't think this happened as well. So this, again, is unprecedented. These steps are all being taken, not through informal sources, but straight from the heart of government, saying you cannot go to the pub. You cannot do this. You can't do that. And as I say, in other countries, we're seeing it enforced on an even greater, more stringent level as well. So looking at the examples of Italy, Spain, of course, China, and as well, Russia as well. We're now on to the orange and pineapple lemon squash, by the way, so I'm just going to have a little sip of this. Oh, that's not, yeah, it's nice, nice. Not quite as good as peach, but, you know, we can't all be perfect, can we? Let's talk a little bit about informal social control, because I actually find this almost more interesting. So, again, we've already talked to you about the ways in which the media have started to use informal social control for the examples of like public criticism and shaming and ostracization, for example, shaming panic buyers. But also, we've got to think about the way in which the media are acting as an agent of social control through the advice that they're offering us. So things like, you know, keeping us at home, making sure that we don't have social contact, making sure that we keep our social distancing and our isolation from people, making sure that workplaces shut down, people putting pressure on these groups. So again, another example yesterday, I mean, bloody hell, I listen to the news quite a lot because I'm in the car quite a lot. But on the radio yesterday, you may be aware that in Britain, there's this big chain of pubs called Wetherspoons, and that they are a very popular chain of pubs, cheap. And they had the CEO of them, Tim, I forget his second name now, and he was saying against government advice, no, there's no need not to go to the pub. You can still go to the pub. It's really important. You know, there's loads of room here. No one's exactly going at the moment, so you can enjoy yourself. But again, within, I think, about sort of 7-8 hours of that, him coming out and making that statement, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, comes out and said, nope, tonight is the last night of drinking in pubs. Again, using the media as a conduit to pass that message on, basically. So there we go. We've got some sort of informal social control as well. But one of the things I really want to talk about this is perhaps what's been going on, not only in the UK, but definitely abroad, is the concept of surveillance and how the state is keeping an eye both on the health of its citizens and indeed what citizens are doing. You know, are they actually out and about? Are they attempting to cross borders? And so what we've seen really with surveillance, what it means effectively is watching people, keeping an eye on people. So at various different countries, like I'm thinking of the likes of Spain and Italy, got quite a lot of borders. They're doing temperature checks at country borders. They're testing people for corona. We've got CCTV cameras in China that are checking who's out and about. We've seen examples of drones flying around and telling people to quarantine themselves. So these drones are, and they've got like a loudspeaker on them, they're flying to a particular area, often that might have a large quantity of people, so like a town square or something like that. Drones are flying over, they're hovering down, and they're literally telling people, go back in your houses, keep your distance from each other. That is a wonderful example of the government and the state surveilling society and then enforcing social control as a result of it. But one of the other things, and this is going to lead into my final discussion, which will link into Foucault, is about the concept of self-surveillance, by people being proactive about following the advice that have been given, by self-isolating and being more aware of precautions. So I'll come back to that example again that I gave a moment ago about the bloke in the pub not washing his hands. That's self-surveillance. People are watching each other. And according to Foucault, this is almost like the gold standard of surveillance, because we've got to a situation whereby the agents of social control, whether they be formal or informal, aren't having to do that job of surveillance to the extent that they might have to be, because we've got informal agents like the bloke in the pub chastising that fella, like the fella on the Tony Livesey on the radio telling people to have a long hard look at themselves. We've got informal agents of social control who are actually helping people to self-surveil themselves. I think that's a word, but you know, watch themselves and be aware of what they're doing. And so how does this link into Foucault? Well, Foucault had this big idea about how we can control society through the concept of the panopticon. The panopticon is a prison structure where basically, if you imagine like almost like a circle, and if you put, I'm doing it now, I wish I had a webcam, but in many ways I don't. I'm putting my hands into a circle, and that circle that's on the outside, that would be where prisoners sit, so that would be their cells are all the way around, and in the middle there's like a central watchtower. And the idea is that central watchtower can actually see and survey I don't even know, is it a word? Surveil? I'm just going to keep using the word. They can surveil, survey, it's survey, it's survey. They can survey what's going on. My God, I'm an idiot. They can survey what's going on in all of those prison cells without having to move. Now, the key thing about the concept of the panopticon for Foucault is this. It's that prisoners cannot see whether there's a guard in the panopticon, but the guards can always see the prisoners. Now, what that ultimately leads to, again, is this concept of self-surveillance. So if the prisoners aren't aware that they're always being watched, but they know that they could be being watched, what this leads to is the idea of self-surveillance through the idea that actually someone could be watching me, and even if they're... someone could well be watching me, and even if they're not, I don't know that they're not, but I'm going to have to assume that they are, because there's this bloody great watchtower up there, and they could be controlling us through that. So the idea of surveillance is... in itself enough to police and control us. We are effectively now on many, many levels controlling and policing ourselves through following that guidance from the government, following guidelines, doing what we're supposed to do, doing what we are told. We are policing ourselves. And at the moment, it feels like in the UK, we've got this mix of formal social control through the example of the government issuing state instructions, potentially with the mobilisation of military on Britain's streets, which is something that we don't see except in high cases of anomie. And indeed, this is an incredible time of anomie at the moment, because we just don't have our norms. We can't do what we normally do. And as a result, crime, if you take Durkheim's argument or any of the functionalist writers, crime will increase at any time of anomie when there's normlessness, because people don't know what's going on. You add into that the mix of this uncertainty about people's economic futures, because people are losing their jobs, they're not getting paid, they're not going to be able to pay their mortgage, their rent, their bills, they're not going to be able to put food on the table. You know, this is, we've got a recipe for disaster here, but it does certainly feel like, personally, from my point of view, that through a combination of formal social control and informal social control, we probably will get through this. But it's the fact that we need both elements, formal and informal, to help this work. So there we are, 46 minutes we're into, and I've kind of come to the end. So that's an unusual podcast. I wasn't really planning on doing this, as I say, and I certainly didn't prepare in any way properly for this. I've literally written down a few notes on a bit of paper and gone through some of my ideas, and I hope that it hasn't been a complete load of gobbledygook. I hope it's sort of made some kind of sense to you as well, because I did sort of hastily put this together. But let's just recap what we've gone through. So we started off by looking at the concept of moral panic, linking that into Stan Cohen's 1972 Folk Devils and Moral Panics, The Mods and the Rockers, and how the coronavirus can be seen as a moral panic by looking at the different components of that concept, so moral, the panic part, and indeed the folk devil part. I also considered the ways in which it couldn't be considered a moral panic, but argued perhaps that it's only because we've never had to, or never had to think about applying Cohen's concept to a virus. We then led into a discussion on the role of the media and the ways in which the media is kind of informing us of the developments in coronavirus. I was talking to you a little bit about the ways in which it had a personal effect on me, having not watched the news for sort of 4 or 5 days, and it physically increased my sense of anxiety. We looked at a bunch of different examples of media sensationalism, potentials of fake news, and also we brought in Baudrillard's concepts of hyperreality and also of simulacrum into that, and the way in which we're actually experiencing the coronavirus for the vast majority of us is ultimately through the media. We're not getting this firsthand. I then led on to a bit of a discussion about how the coronavirus has led to the social construction of new forms of deviance, and how deviance is relative and how it changes very quickly, by giving you an example of the bloke in the pub who wasn't washing his hands and got baited out by someone who was washing his hands. And all the meanwhile, I was just stood at the urinal just watching this all happen. And then finally, we've finished off there by considering, kind of pulling this all together, by considering the role that social control has in this, by considering formal social control. So the examples I gave were those of governments, lockdowns, and those kind of things, but also the agents of informal social control. So ourselves, our peers, the media, schools, and even our families as well, also all playing our role, playing our part in keeping people controlled, making sure that people are doing what they should be doing, following the advice of the government. And I finished all that off by just sort of linking that into Foucault's concept of a panopticon, and through the concept and the idea that actually we're all really just self-surveilling. I've still screwed it up. Self-surveying ourselves, self-surveillance of ourselves. So there we go. That's me done. So what's coming up? Well, I've got another podcast that I've already prepped and it's good to go. And I just haven't got around to recording it yet. So that one's going to be on the theories of crime. And I think I mentioned this a little while ago. Leanne and I did a pod on some of the key sort of topics in crime at A level. This one is a little bit more basic. So I'm going to sort of pitch it at somewhere between like year 11, we'll suggest GCSE and A level level. I'm going to talk about functionalism and Merton and Strain. I'm going to throw in some feminist views of crime and deviance. We'll have a look at some Marxist and neo-Marxist views. I'll throw in some new right views and right realist views. I'll give some interactionist perspectives on crime and deviance. And obviously, you kind of have to, when you're doing crime, talk about some cultural explanations. So that's something that's in the pipeline. I'll probably get around to doing that, hopefully, excuse me, in the next week or so. But again, as always, let me know if you want anything covered. If I get enough requests to do something, you know, whether that be, I don't know, positivism, interpretivism, or value freedom, or whatever it might be, I'll do it. So just let me know. Drop me a line on Instagram. Pop a message under any, or pop a comment under any photograph up there. I will see it. It's the best way to see it. As I've said before, I try not to do direct messages for various reasons. I've seen in the last week, I think I've had about 15 of them that I haven't got around to even looking at. Apologies if you've asked me something that you really needed urgently. I just haven't had the time. I will get back to them in due course. Once again, shout out to everyone who's listened to this. This is definitely going to be the longest one of these I've done so far. Shout out to every single listener. Genuinely thank you. I find it brilliant and like amazing that people are actually listening to this and getting stuff out of this, let alone actually requesting me to do more of these. So that's awesome. If you are listening to this, if you listen to this on Apple, iTunes, podcasts, I would absolutely love it. One of the things you can do to help me out is to stick a 5-star review on Apple iTunes podcasts. I think they do something similar on Google podcasts as well. So this I'm not discriminated against Android listeners by any means. If you can whack a 5-star review on that, what that means basically is it makes me look good and I like that. So that's great. Any comments you want to make, that'd be awesome. No one's put a comment yet. So I'd love to hear what you've got to say. And the other thing as well is if you've liked it, if you study sociology and you think, well, this might be helpful, just subscribe to it. That's the easiest way to do it. And then every time I pop one of these out, it will come straight to you rather than you having to look at it or me telling you about it. So that's it, really. That's where we are, what we're up to. As I said, I'm not going to talk too much about school closures and stuff. I'm going to leave that to a slightly more personal message to my own students as well. I've got so much to say to you guys. But in a nutshell, I'm so proud of all of you. I miss you already. And you're all going to do just fine. But I'll talk to you about that in a more appropriate forum. The last thing just to do today is just to finish off my shout outs to the winners of the World Class Wednesday quiz. So on the 19th of March 2020, I asked everybody for the name and the year of the policy that brought in the tripartite system in UK education. Now, what I was looking for with that was something like the Education Act or the Butler Act, and the year was 1944. I've only included the people who got at least the policy right, and in many cases the date. If you just gave me the date, I have like acknowledged that, but I haven't actually credited you with that, just purely because I wanted the name of it and ideally the policy. If I've got any of your names wrong, if I've missed anyone out, I'm really, really sorry. I know that I butcher your names, but I'm going to do it my best by going through this now. So here are those people who are wonderful. Jack Gilbanks or Jillbanks, well done to you. Epra Sadstack, well done to you. Gemma Skibberis, well done. Jess Jones, nice one, Jess. AKB Priv, well done you. Rihanna.dredge Mariner, well done to you. Tasha_Jen, well done. Adam28265, well done, Adam. Christian, I can't read the second bit, mate, because it's kind of like too long. But Christian, well done to you. Emmy McCarthy, well done. Jam, easy, 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 seen you a couple of times. Well done, Jam. Shuab Khan, I think, mate, I'm so sorry I pronounced your name wrong, but I know who you are. Hope you're doing well. Georgie _GW, well done, Georgie. Thank you very much. Maria.vh, well done you. Cora_Hunt3R. Indian Kids, iFletCE. K Putley, XOXMZ.XOX, well done to you. Sharnob09, sorry. Will_Ski, well done, Will. Pelt1978, DICKOCF7, well done you. TaylorBird82, Nabzilias, I think that's how you pronounce your name, I'm sorry. Dan Thompson, as always, and ever present Dan Thompson, well done you, mate. TreeDickens_42. Well done, you. Well done, JSCO2. Well done, James. Nice one. Jack Ted Smith, seen you up here loads of times, mate. Well done. I saw I got a message from you. I will get back to you. Well done, mate. Chloe Louise 21, Sarah 2, well done. Tahira.m, I'm nearly there. Wazza 36, well done. I've got about 10 more to go. Amy Tuck 01, well done. Umar London, I've seen you several times. Well done, mate. Rux.xox, well done. Leon_Cumberland, Arunk Dosanja, well done, you. Oscar Stokes, still rocking it, Oscar. Love it, mate. Well done. Adam Woodland 08, Joe Joyce, Hannah Summers, Saz 111, Saz 111, and Chair Jam. That's it. All of you are wonderful because you all knew that the tripartite system was indeed part of the Education Act or the Butler Act, and that was in 1944. Just a little mention, the Education Reform Act, that was the one brought in by Thatcher in 1988, and that saw things like, you know, marketisation principles, introduction of GCSEs, Ofsted, league tables, blah, 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 blah. Could go on, not going to. So there we go. That was my podcast on sociological applications to the coronavirus. I hope you've enjoyed it. My name's Ben. I'll be back again for another podcast anytime soon. Keep on following on the Instagram. Keep on liking. Keep on subscribing. I love it. Big fans of all of you. Thank you so much for your support. I will see you again, or speak to you again, hopefully in a few days. Take care, people. Keep washing their hands, and big up yourselves. Well done. Ta-ra. Bye.